If you have an iPhone, you already know you can use it to do almost anything from ordering pizza to having your television record a program from across town. Now, in Boston at least, you can use your iPhone to let City Hall know what's on your mind. Boston has just launched what some might call the Killer Complainer app. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
A few weeks ago, 41-year-old Heather Sears thought the coolest app on her iPhone was Sit or Squat, a listing of the city's cleanest, closest restrooms. But today, she's even more excited about Boston's Citizens Connect that basically lets her make a one-touch fetch about anything that's not so good in her hood.
I was thrilled to be able to walk down the alley to where I parked my car and say, all right, there's more graffiti. I want it off now. And the satisfaction of taking that picture and sending it in.
You were like armed.
I was armed and dangerous, yes.
For the 10 years she's lived in Boston's South End, Sears is the first to confess she's been a complainer, repeatedly making irate calls to City Hall about everything from potholes to broken streetlights. But now all Sears has to do is snap a picture of a problem with her iPhone. The location coordinates automatically embed in the photo, and her complaint goes hurtling through the bureaucracy of City Hall straight out to the public works crews around the city.
My graffiti picture is going to the dude who's going to go fix that graffiti, you know, directly to the dude. And that feels good.
You have hope they'll actually do something.
Yeah, I expect them to. And I'm watching. I am watching.
After a complaint is made, a red dot marks the problem on a map you can see on your iPhone. And if you keep checking, you'll see the dot turn green when your problem is fixed.
It'll be more instant gratification. I'm doing it and it's done. And I don't have to get irate when I'm finally calling the nice people at the call center.
Good afternoon, the mayor's office.
Alan Christopher has heard her share of irate at Boston's 24-hour hotline, from the guy ranting and raving about a paternity test to the countless calls about dead animals in the road, potholes that need filling, and streets that need a snowplow.
People tend to get very whiny, and naturally it's the mayor's fault.
As often as not, people calling the hotline want more than their potholes filled. As hotline staffer Frank McDonough puts it, they want a piece of you.
Sometimes it's just the venting process that makes them feel better. You know, yelling at the guy at the mayor's office, you know. So.
Oh, definitely. There's a lot of value to a human at the other end.
City officials say that won't change. Even the mayor's technology guru, Nigel Jacob, knew enough to keep a human option. Of course, for those without an iPhone, but also for those too hot-headed to use one.
We have the hot button for that. It's like, I can't, my fingers are numb with fury. I can't type. I'm just going to call.
Get me City Hall now. Okay, I need to take someone's head off.
That's right.
Or if biting someone's head off doesn't do it for you, a bit of biting sarcasm still works, even over the iPhone. The first complaint that came through the new system was one about a streetlight not working. The photo attached was solid black. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
And now a poem, premiered here for the first time. 'Tis just weeks before Christmas, and on planes everywhere, Kindles are glowing to Amazon's delight, and tucked in between the clothes and TVs, book bargains are waiting at your favorite big box store. That doesn't rhyme. Even the shelves of your neighborhood bookstore are stuffed with blockbusters galore. So will it all end up with a season to celebrate, or will booksellers cry humbug when the shopping's all done? NPR's Lynn Neary takes a peek at the bookseller's holiday.
Last year at this time, the bleak economy cast a pall over the bookselling business. Publishers were laying off workers, and shoppers were proceeding with caution, even for supposedly recession-proof purchases like books. But this year, the outlook is brighter, says Steve Berkew, co-owner of the Book People Bookstore in Austin, Texas.
The books are better, and the mood is better, and the year has actually been going better.
Berkew says his business has benefited by the number of big-name authors who came out with books this year, with Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol leading the pack.
Well, there's just a lot of books out that are by well-known authors, and these books bring people in because they're well-known and people are already familiar with them, and it's comfortable ground for them, and they come in to look at the books.
But that bonanza of bestsellers didn't pan out for all booksellers. Sue Boucher, owner of the Lake Forest Bookstore in Illinois, says she keeps waiting for sales to take off, but so far they haven't.
Not really, no. Just when you think, okay, this month will go crazy, you know what? I mean, it was okay, but not what you'd think. But we sold a fair number of Dan Brown. So it's not like we didn't sell it. We definitely sold it. But it was just, I think, other things.
Other things, like the way people buy books these days.
People are doing more buying online, and I hear people all the time talking about, you know, electronic books.
Yeah. Are you surprised by that electronic books have taken off to the degree they have?
Not really, but for me, it's a disturbing trend. You know, how will it affect me in the end? I don't know.
The dominance of Amazon in book sales has long been the independent bookseller's lament. But this holiday season, Amazon's books are taking a back seat to their electronic book reader, the Kindle.
It's the number one best-selling product across Amazon, in both units and revenue.
Amazon's Russ Grandinetti says the company is so happy with the sales of their digital reader, they don't really care what kind of book their customers buy, e-books or traditional books. Either way, it works for them.
Because even our Kindle customers today, many of them really, really are passionate about reading on Kindle and are excited to buy books on Kindle. But many of them go right on, for different reasons, buying physical books, and we think that's great.
Another big player, Barnes & Noble, has gotten into the e-book business with its own digital reader, the Nook. The only problem, at this point, if you want one for a Christmas present, it won't arrive till January.
Well, this is definitely a win for Amazon, but it's not necessarily a huge black mark in consumers' minds against Barnes & Noble.
Sarah Rotman-Epps, an analyst with Forrester Research, says Barnes & Noble didn't want to miss out on the chance to publicize this new product during the biggest sales season of the year. And she thinks in the end, it was probably a good move.
Barnes & Noble has done a good job of notifying consumers that have pre-ordered Nooks to let them know, when to expect that the Nook will actually ship, and has offered them a gift certificate for a free ebook as compensation for not having something to open under the tree.
As far as not having something to open under the tree, well, you can't put a pretty bow on an ebook, and that's where traditional booksellers still have an advantage. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here. And Lee, this week the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation released a report with important information about Americans and their financial management techniques. According to a report released on Wednesday, a significant number of American households, nearly 8% or 9 million, are unbanked, meaning they have no bank account. The findings were especially high among minority groups. Lee, you blogged about this on our website, and quite a few people wrote back. What did they say?
Hey, Michelle. Well, many people were not surprised by the FDIC findings, and I'll read a post here from blogger Jashir. He writes, "I'm a 27-year-old software developer with a master's degree. At this time last year, my entire department was cut, and I was suddenly out of a job. In March of this year, I managed to find a job, but it was a severe pay cut. I fell behind in my bills, my accounts went overdrawn, and I couldn't afford to pay the bank and pay my bills. Since May, I've only dealt in cash. The two bank accounts I had prior to my financial crisis ended up being the biggest contributors to my financial debt."
Well, thanks, Jashir. Good luck with everything. This week, we reported on Crashergate. That's the story about the Virginia couple, the Salahis, who were somehow able to bypass security at the Obama administration's first state dinner just before Thanksgiving. The whole thing has prompted plenty of questions and finger-pointing, some of it directed at White House Social Secretary Desiree Rogers. She's the first African-American to hold that post. She's kind of a glamorous figure in her own right, and she's been criticized for not having someone from her office present to assist the Secret Service in clearing in guests. We'll talk about this more coming up in our barbershop segment, but recently we posed this question on Facebook. Was the breach in security the fault of the Salahis or White House Social Secretary Desiree Rogers?
And Michelle, we caught up with blogger Brent, one of our Facebook friends, who had this to say.
It's the Salahis' fault primarily for essentially trespassing. It's the Secret Service's fault secondarily for letting people not on the list in. Why should it be necessary for the Social Secretary to be at the door? She was at the event. If there was an issue, someone could have easily found her and asked her about it. The Secret Service person who let them in should be fired for not doing their job and being too lazy to ask if these people should have been let in or not.
Okay, thanks, Brent. And Michelle, I should mention that most of the replies faulted the U.S. Secret Service, and we've learned that those agents at the state dinner have since been placed on administrative leave.
Lee, any other updates?
Last month, we reported on a gruesome discovery in Cleveland, Ohio, where 11 decomposing bodies were found in the home of Anthony Sowell, who now stands accused of multiple murders. Well, yesterday, Sowell pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. Also, we've been following that mayoral race in Atlanta, where City Councilmember Mary Norwood and State Senator Kasim Reed faced each other in a runoff to become the city's next chief executive. While we called the Wall Street Journal's Corey Dade for an update, he tells us that Reed has claimed victory, but Norwood may yet call for a recount, but the race has yet to be officially called. We expect that it could be called this weekend.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave us your name. You can also log on to our new website, where you can read more from fellow listeners and enjoy a simpler social networking experience. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
More news on the climate change conference. Late yesterday, President Obama announced he's changing the timing of his visit. Previously planned to stop in Denmark on Wednesday while en route to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo. Now he says he'll go to Copenhagen on December 18th, when more world leaders will be in attendance. The U.S. is entering that conference after already reaching an agreement with China that both countries will work toward what they call significant efforts to cut down emissions. President Obama is expected to declare at the conference the U.S. will cut its own carbon emissions by more than 80% over the next 40 years. We're joined now by Maria Otero, Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs at the State Department. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, let me ask you about what we're told will be the president's goal of cutting emissions by 80% over the next 40 years. I'm struck by a piece that Richard K. Lester, who's head of the Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT, had in Friday's Wall Street Journal, where he said it's just not realistic to think that that goal can be achieved without major reliance on nuclear energy. And he said a lot of the president's environmentalist allies don't like nuclear energy. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think this is one of the considerations that we have to take into place. But there, I don't know that we can think and rely only on this question of nuclear energy. Clearly, there are many other issues that will affect emissions as we move forward in the coming decades. And I think we're seeing on the part of the president's efforts an attempt to really move us in the direction of addressing renewable energy. As you know, that's already been built into the economic recovery efforts. Addressing fuel efficiency and looking at how we can look at vehicle efficiency, at appliance efficiency, it does mean in many ways that we also need to look at the way in which we use energy. Certainly,
let me press you a bit on this, if I could, Undersecretary Otero, because I think you probably know that what Dr. Lester was saying is not that those other energies you cite aren't worth pursuing. He just said it is not realistic to think that that ambitious goal of 80%, cutting emissions by 80% of the next 40 years, will be met without nuclear energy. He's got nothing against the other forms.
Sure.
He just says that, if I may, I think his language was even stronger. He thought people that think you can leave nuclear energy out are not being honest.
Well, that is one of the areas that I think we really do need to look into. But there are so many other areas that need to be addressed as well. And certainly the president is putting forth the kind of targets that we want to move towards. And certainly as we're looking at moving towards 80% reduction by 2050, we still need to look at reducing emissions for 2020, you know, in sort of smaller amounts as we move mm-hmm. forward. We really do need to take, if you will, this decade at a time as we move in.
Now, are you reluctant to even mouth the phrase nuclear energy because you don't want to offend another part of President Obama's supposed political base?
No, not at all. I think it is, you know, as we are looking at climate change, we are going to have to look at all the possible ways in which we're going to address the question of energy efficiency and of really moving our country and really moving the world towards a clean energy world. And I think we are going to have to look at all the different possible ways in which we can do that.
Maria Otero, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listening to NPR News.
NPR's business news starts with a digital music deal. Apple has bought an upstart online music retailer called La La Media. The deal could expand Apple's music offerings. It already owns iTunes and, of course, make online music available more quickly and at a lower cost than ever before. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports.
Apple wouldn't say how much it paid for LaLa.com, but it did confirm that the purchase took place. LaLa.com claims to have such a fast song streaming application, it could rewrite the way we download our music. LaLa gives users the option of downloading MP3s for 89 cents each, or buy a stream-only version of the song for 10 cents. An entire stream-only album would cost about a dollar. And while the sound quality is not as good as what you can get on your iPod from iTunes, it's much less expensive. And with more and more iTunes users carrying iPhones and iPod Touches, which have less storage space, streaming music might be the way of the future. The music streaming is a new incarnation for LaLa.com. It started out as a CD swapping service, and then last year joined forces with major music labels to launch this streaming and downloading application. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
It was worth having that report just to hear Dina repeatedly say LaLa, 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 LaLa.
Next time you hit a pothole and find yourself cursing your local mayor, you might want to reconsider, because those potholes could, eventually, save you money at the gas pump. That's the thinking, at least, of a group of friends, all recent graduates from MIT. They came up with a way to harness the energy from a truck's shock absorber and channel it back into the vehicle. Now, over the next few weeks, we're going to take a look at some of the interesting inventions of the past year. And Zach Anderson, are you there?
I am, hey.
We're going to start with your invention. It's called GenShock. Tell us how it works.
So the device, basically, as you're driving down the road, energy is lost when you go over small bumps in the road. And what we created is a device that harnesses that lost energy through the shock absorber. So a standard shock in a car, it typically dissipates heat. So it just wastes energy as heat. And what we've created is a device that does the same thing as a standard shock, but it generates electricity instead.
Now, Jack, you just graduated from MIT last June, right?
That's right.
So did you guys spend, like, all-nighters in your dorm rooms figuring out how to make it work? I mean, how did the process sort of play out?
We were thinking about fuel-saving solutions in a vehicle, because the thing is that about 20% of the energy in each gallon of gasoline is actually used to move the vehicle forward. It's really amazing. 20%. That's nothing. So we were thinking, where is energy lost in a vehicle? And we were thinking about different locations, and nothing really came to us. And one day we're driving down a bumpy road, and we were all in Silicon Valley for the summer, working there, and it hit us. It said, you know, what about, so what about the bumpy road?
Hmm.
Is there energy there? So that was step one.
Zach, explain, how much more efficient, I mean, you're in the prototype phase still now, but how much more efficient could your shocks make, say, you know, an 18-wheeler big rig?
We're talking about a few percent, the ballpark of 3% our initial testing is showing, and something in that neighborhood, even just 2-3%, we're talking about saving a fleet. So, for example, Walmart has 7,200 trucks. We're talking about saving them over $13 million a year. At the current price of diesel.
Wow, that's incredible. Right now, I understand you guys are working on a prototype for the U.S. military, primarily to be used maybe on Humvees, military vehicles. Is there any chance that the GenTech will show up in our regular cars soon?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that hybrid vehicles now, they have one source of energy recovery, really. Most of them, you brake and it generates electricity. Mm. Well, there's more losses in a car than just braking. And I think the future of the car, the future of the electrified car, of the hybrid or the electric, is going to be recovering energy from a number of sources. And I think the suspension is the next stepping stone. It's going to be down the line. It's not going to be next year, but I think it's going to be there, and that's our target.
That's Zach Anderson. He's one of the founders of Levant Power. It's a company that makes the GenShock Absorber. It's one of the thousands of innovative products invented this year. Zach, good luck to you guys.
Thank you very much.